Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, I am Siegfried, and it's been a momentous last week. I believe it was Justin Podor on one of his episodes on the Anti-Empire podcast was saying, like, this is one of the weeks that Lenin talked about where, like, you know, centuries take place in a matter of days, like, just about, you know, it's, we've had two pivotal court rulings in, you know, the ICC, International Criminal Court, issuing arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli PM, and the Israeli Defense Minister, which has been sending shockwaves around the collective West, around the world. And we also have the ICJ ruling, telling Israel to basically stop its brutal onslaught on Rafah, in the besieged Gaza Strip. Now, Israel has actually been flaunting those, you know, very deliberately flaunting those that ruling, and has actually escalated its assault on Rafah, its genocidal assault on Rafah, which we've been talking on this show you know, many other people have been warning this, that this was going to happen. I mean, this has been telegraphed long in advance. Israel was going to move into Rafah. It was going to attack Rafah, even though this is where, you know, literally millions of Palestinians have been taking refuge from the war. And were driven there from when they were driven out of their homes in other parts of the Gaza Strip in previous months. And this is, and they pretty much have nowhere else to go. And but Israel has gone in; it's been attacking there. And just today, you know, I received, you know, I got the news that like 50 Palestinians have been civilians were burned to death in an attack on a UN school, UN relief compound in Rafah, and you know, most of the dead were kids. That's the kind of situation that we're seeing on the ground, the absolutely horrific situation as this genocidal onslaught continues. You know, the Israeli apartheid state besieging and attempting to destroy the Palestinian people in Gaza. But the Palestinian people are fighting back, and Israel is facing just multiple military setbacks. They can't hold on to any territory they capture. You know, the resistance is attacking them again and again and again. You know, sniper attacks, bombings, mortars, you know, missile attacks on tanks, this sort of thing. Like, it's just, you know, constant resistance. You know, they can't, no matter where they go into, they're, you know, there's the pushback from the resistance, like, you know, grinding them down, inflicting casualties, and just making it so the Israelis cannot prosecute this genocidal war in the way that they want to. You know, and of course I've talked about how Israel's also bogged down in Lebanon, where it's fighting Hezbollah, and how resistance forces in Iraq, resistance forces in Yemen, they're also like part of the mix, fighting back against Israel, containing and constraining what Israel can do. And so Israel's hands are very much tied. And like, in a lot of cases, this violence, this horrific violence they're meting out, is almost, you see the desperation, because you know they're losing. They know they're losing. And increasingly, this is all they've got. This is all they've got, is to kill kids in a refugee camp. You know, this is the level of desperation, because they're basically losing the actual war. You know, they're facing resistance they can't deal with. So I want to go to the Gray Zone's analysis of the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, ruling on Israel, telling them to stop this onslaught on Rafah. The Gray Zone actually had some pretty decent coverage of this over the weekend, so I want to go to that right now. And of course, the Gray Zone, that's Max Blumenthal in there and Mate. So I'm going to cut to that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I think one of the biggest developments, Aaron, is a new ICJ ruling. I don't know if you want to brief us on that.
Yeah, well, let's hear it. This is the ICJ in response to the South African case ordering Israel to halt its assault on Rafah.
The court considered that in conformity with the obligations under the Genocide Convention, Israel must immediately halt its military offensive and any other action in the Rafah governorate, which may inflict on the Palestinian group in Gaza conditions of life that could bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part.
So there's the ruling. And what does Israel do in response to this order from the ICJ to halt the operation, the assault on Rafah? It escalates it. As we're speaking, it's engaged in outright carpet bombing of Rafah.
Yeah, well, there are several things we'll break down around about what's happening around Rafah politically and militarily. This is one of the attacks that's happened in the last. And the Kuwaiti hospital, which is one of the few main functioning hospitals in the center of Rafah, which I visited, is filling up. It's completely overflowing with casualties. Now, if we look at the destruction of Rafah, it's important to kind of understand why this is significant. Basically, this is a GIF showing the destruction of Rafah, where basically the Biden administration said that it had a red line here, especially to the west of Rafah, where most of the refugees had fled from the north of Gaza. Since the start of Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip, something like 39% of the buildings in and around Rafah have been destroyed. And the Biden administration, as we now know, has kind of agreed to roll back its red line. One of the reasons they're doing so is they claim that something like 600,000 people have gone back to the northern areas, back to cities like Deir al-Balah or Khan Yunis, where Israel has momentarily withdrawn its forces. They always say, we destroyed Hamas's battalions there, we're withdrawing, and then they show up a few weeks or months later because they didn't actually finish the job and Hamas reconstitutes because they're militarily failing. Israel is. But now we can see that they're moving more deeply into Rafah, destroying the city after guaranteeing and getting that guarantee accepted by the Biden administration that they were going to just do a quote unquote light operation, a targeted, more precise operation than what we saw in the north, where they simply destroyed everything. And where are they advancing from? They're advancing from the Philadelphia corridor, which is to the south of Rafah. Israel's claiming there are too many tunnels still active, allowing Hamas to be resupplied. And so they've occupied that area and they're moving north. And this is, you know, in complete contravention of what they told the Biden administration. They completely lied, and the Biden administration is just providing cover for them by feeding the press this lie that it's just a precise targeted operation. It's not happening at all. So they're doing, and then they're flouting the ICJ decision today.
You're listening to Back in USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and that was the Gray Zone's analysis of the Israel's response to the ruling of the International Court of Justice, telling it to basically back off of Rafah. And Israel instead is flouting that, and I believe there's been about 50 or 60 airstrikes in the last 24 hours just on Rafah. So we see the genocidal onslaught continues, but so does the resistance. And as I said before, Israel is losing basically on all fronts now, and its violence is increasingly desperate in character. What I want to cut to now is the Electronic Intifada's analysis of the other very pivotal, like, international court ruling over the last week, which is the ruling of the ICC, the International Criminal Court, in its decision to charge top Israeli leaders with war crimes. So the Electronic Intifada did a very good analysis of this. So I'm going to cut to that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in USSR.
But first, we're going to talk more about the historic announcement on Monday by the International Criminal Court prosecutor Karim Khan that he's seeking arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. He's also seeking to arrest three leaders of the Palestinian resistance. Hi, Ali. How are you?
Hi, Nora. Thank you for that tremendous opening report. It's so much information. It's so overwhelming. It's always difficult to watch, but thank you for keeping the focus on what's happening by bringing that all together. And just watching those kids at the end, my heart.
I know. Yeah, it's hard to keep it together sometimes. Well, let's talk about the ICC. Let's start by taking a look at a short clip of Monday's closely watched announcement by Karim Khan.
I can also confirm today that I have reasonable grounds to believe on the basis of evidence collected and examined by my office, that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Minister of Defense Yoav Gallant bear criminal responsibility for the following international crimes committed on the territory of the State of Palestine from at least the 8th of October 2023. The crimes include starvation of civilians as a method of warfare, willfully causing great suffering, serious injury to body or health, or cruel treatment, willful killing or murder, and intentionally directing attacks against a civilian population, as well as crimes against humanity of extermination and or murder, persecution.
So let's start with an overview of what happened before we get into some of the discussion and nuances about what this means. What did Karim Khan charge Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant with?
Right. Well, you heard some of it there. And of course, there's a document that went with his press conference that goes into more detail. So just briefly, he charged them with seven different crimes under the Rome Statute, including starvation as a method of warfare, as a war crime, willfully causing great suffering or serious injury to body or health, willful killing or murder as a war crime, intentionally directing attacks against a civilian population as a war crime, extermination and or murder, including in the context of deaths caused by starvation as a crime against humanity, persecution as a crime against humanity, and other inhumane acts as crimes against humanity. And Khan says the crimes he mentions, quote, occurred through the imposition of a total siege over Gaza that involved completely closing the three border crossings, Rafah, Kerem Shalom, and Erez, from 8 October 2023 for extended periods, and then arbitrarily restricting the transfers of essential supplies, including food and medicine. He also mentions other attacks on civilians, including those queuing for food, obstruction of aid, delivery by humanitarian agencies, and attacks on and killing of aid workers, which forced many agencies to cease or limit their operations in Gaza. So that's Gaza. So that's a flavor of some of the charges he laid out in his statement.
Does this mean that Khan charged the Israeli leaders with genocide?
No. And that's a very important point. He did not lay any charges under Chapter 6 of the Rome Statute, which is the founding document of the International Criminal Court. And that's the chapter that covers the crime of genocide. All the charges against both the Israeli and Palestinian leaders are under chapters 7 and 8, which deal with crimes against humanity and war crimes. Now, the crimes that we heard listed, things like murder, willful killing, extermination, starvation, and so on, can be elements of the crime of genocide, but he does not specifically charge genocide, which in my view is quite shocking. What distinguishes genocide is it's a crime of intent. You have to prove that certain acts, for example, murder or extermination, are committed with intent to destroy a people in whole or in part. Now, many experts have pointed out that there has been no more clear-cut case of genocide than Israel's attack on Gaza since October 7th, because Israeli leaders from Prime Minister Netanyahu down have been so explicit in stating their intent and desire to annihilate Palestinians. Of course, you'll remember Netanyahu's notorious reference to the biblical Amalek, where, you know, he calls to exterminate infants and mothers and everyone. And South Africa laid out many of these statements in its International Court of Justice case against Israel. So it's really shocking that Khan has not charged Israeli leaders with genocide, at least so far.
Yeah. What else did Khan leave out?
Well, he left out a lot. The charges that he leveled against the Israeli leaders only relate to events after October 7th. So for Khan, history starts on that day, and nothing Israel did to the Palestinians before then is even included in the charges. And choosing to start the clock at October 7th allows Khan to paint Hamas as the aggressor and Israel as the victim, which I think is really quite wrong and unjust. He even mentions in his statement that Israel has a right to defend itself, although, of course, he says that that can't include criminal activity. So Khan has simply ignored all of Israel's previous crimes, including its wars on Gaza in 2014 and 2021, and its massacre of unarmed civilian demonstrators during the Great March of Return in 2018. He also ignores Israel's ongoing crimes in the West Bank, including the construction of settlements, which is a war crime specifically listed in the Rome Statute. These are all things that he could have charged Israeli leaders or military officers with. And the previous prosecutor, the person who held his office until a couple of years ago, Fatou Bensouda, had done a lot of preliminary investigations and preparatory work on all those crimes. But for now, at least, Khan seems to be ignoring all of that.
I mean, he really did just throw all of, you know, this work that has been done for decades and decades, not only by people like Fatou Bensouda, but also, primarily Palestinian rights organizations that have been documenting these violations of international law for decades. He just threw it in the trash.
Well, we have to hope he didn't, because yeah. He said that investigations are ongoing, and he does mention the West Bank in passing. But, all that preparatory work has been done. So the fact that he hasn't charged any of those things yet is not encouraging, but it doesn't mean he might not still do it. And let's hope he will.
Who are the Palestinians? There's three Palestinian leaders and only two Israeli leaders that Karim Khan charged. Who are the Palestinian leaders that have been charged, and what does he accuse them of?
Right. So the three leaders are Ismail Haniyeh, who is the chief of the Politburo of Hamas, so its top civilian leader, and he lives in Doha in Qatar. Yahya Sinwar, who is the political leader of Hamas in Gaza, and Mohammed Daif, who is the commander-in-chief of the Qassam Brigades, which is the military wing of Hamas. And I just listed the crimes, or sort of the headline crimes that Khan charged the two Israeli leaders with, and there were seven. He actually charges the Palestinians with eight crimes. So not only does he charge more Palestinians than Israelis, he also charges them with more crimes. And they are, again, extermination as a crime against humanity, murder, taking hostages as a war crime, rape and other acts of sexual violence as crimes against humanity and as war crimes, torture as a crime against humanity and a war crime, other inhumane acts as war crimes, cruel treatment as a war crime in the context of captivity, and outrages upon personal dignity as a war crime in the context of captivity. And those charges, of course, many of them refer to alleged crimes against the Israelis, who have now who are still held in Gaza, or perhaps some of those who were released back in November.
How credible do you think the charges are against these three Palestinian leaders?
I actually think they're extremely weak for a number of reasons. Khan states, for example, and I'm reading now, that he, again, referring to Yahya Sinwar, Muhammad Deif, and Ismail Haniyeh, that they are, quote, criminally responsible for killing, for the killing of hundreds of Israeli civilians in attacks perpetrated by Hamas, in particular its military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, and other armed groups on 7 October 2023, and taking at least 245 hostages. As part of our investigations, my office has interviewed victims and survivors, including former hostages and eyewitnesses from six major attack locations, Kfar Azza, Hulait, the location of the Supernova Music Festival, Kibbutz Be'eri, Kibbutz Nir Oz, and Kibbutz Nahal Oz, end quote. But notice that he mentions locations such as the Supernova Rave and Kibbutz Be'eri, among others, where we know for a fact that large numbers of Israelis were actually killed by the Israeli military and security forces. But he doesn't mention that at all or say that he's looking into it. And moreover, to convict a commander for their crime, for the crimes of their subordinates, which is something the Rome Statute does allow, you have to prove that that commander had some form of operational control or knowledge and neglected and either gave criminal orders or neglected to act in a way that would have prevented the crimes of these subordinates. But if you take Ismail Haniyeh, for example, he is a civilian leader who, as I said, lives in Qatar. He is far removed from Gaza and almost certainly had no role whatsoever in the planning of the October 7th operation. So under the terms of the Rome Statute, it is just an incredible stretch to try to pin any of this on Ismail Haniyeh, even if Khan can prove that crimes took place. I think that this is one example of the kind of blatant political bias that Khan is showing by charging Ismail Haniyeh while filing no charges against, for example, Herzi Halevi, who is the chief of staff of the Israeli army and has direct command responsibility for all the Israeli forces in Gaza.
Exactly. Talk more about these rape charges. Why do you think that Khan included those? And does that mean he has evidence for Israel's mass rape claims that, as we've shown repeatedly on this live stream and in our reporting, have been thoroughly debunked?
Right. Well, I've actually written about this. I'll ask Tamara to put up the article that we published at the Electronic Intifada yesterday people can find more. But just briefly, the charges of rape and sexual violence relate only to claims of sexual violence against Israelis in captivity, not to anything that allegedly happened on October 7th. And in fact, the statement by Khan and also a report from an expert panel that he convened and that was also published admits that they really do not have any evidence related to the supposed mass rapes on October 7th, at least not anything they think they can make stick. So actually, nothing has changed there. He doesn't have any evidence for these debunked claims about October 7th, or I think he would have included them in the charges. As for the claim of sexual violence against Israeli captives, I believe the evidence here is also very thin. We know of one case, which we've discussed previously on this live stream, of an Israeli woman called Amit Susanna, who was held in Gaza and released in November. And she alleged that while she was in Gaza, one of her guards forced her to carry out an unspecified sexual act on one occasion. Now, even if everything Amit Susanna says is true, the incident that she described does not get anywhere close to rising to the level of rape or sexual violence as a crime against humanity or a war crime in the kind of orchestrated manner that the Rome Statute is referring to. And I think it's surprising that Khan would include such weak charges, but he may well have been trying to placate some of his pro-Israel critics and to show, look how even-handed I'm being. Of course, we haven't seen all the evidence he claims to have, but I'm very skeptical that he has anything more than what the Israelis have already put out during their intense propaganda campaign over the past seven, almost 8 months.
Ali, what's the immediate impact on Israel and the Palestinian leadership?
Yeah, I mean, there's impacts at a number of levels, of course. There's direct impacts for those accused, and there are sort of political and diplomatic and legal impacts. So just procedurally, Khan himself can't issue the arrest warrants. He has to send his request to a panel of judges at the ICC, and they will decide whether or not to issue the arrest warrants. Typically, they will do so at the request of the prosecutor. And that's a process that could take a couple of weeks. I read one report that said the average is 2 months. It may happen sooner. It may take a little bit longer. Once that happens, then all state parties who are signatories to the Rome Statute, who are members of the court, are then obligated to arrest any of these suspects who show up on their territory. For example, the foreign minister of Norway said today that if arrest warrants are issued and if Benjamin Netanyahu or Yoav Gallant show up in Norway, we will be obligated to arrest them. And that will apply to all members of the International Criminal Court. So that obviously is a huge thing for Netanyahu and Gallant, who will be unable to travel to anywhere in Europe and much of the world. There are 124 countries, I think, that are members of the International Criminal Court. And that will be true for other Israeli officials as well, who, even though they haven't been charged, will be in fear that they could be charged at any time. Now, of course, the same applies to the Palestinian leaders in theory. But in practice, I mean, it's not as if Hamas leaders are traveling around the world and being received in these countries anyway. Yahya Sinwar and Mohammed Deif are underground resistance leaders. Nobody knows where they are. They weren't about to go on a tour of Europe. And I suspect that being arrested is actually the least of their concerns. For Ismail Haniyeh, it's a little more complicated because he is a political leader. He does travel. He recently traveled to Moscow, which is not, I believe he did, but at least at some point in the past few months. I believe I read that he was in Tehran today for the funeral of the president of Iran, Ibrahim Raisi. Of course, neither Russia nor Iran are members of the ICC. And as I said, he lives in Qatar. Qatar, interestingly, is one of a handful of countries that is not a signatory to the Rome Statute. So legally speaking, Qatar would not be obligated to arrest him or hand him over. But of course, Qatar is a small country that is, you know, a client state of the United States, essentially. So it could come under political pressure to do so at some point. And then, of course, on the political and diplomatic level, this is huge reputational damage for Israel, cementing its pariah status. It is pretty unprecedented. It is the first real puncturing, as inadequate as this is, as critical as I am of the way that Khan has approached it, it is the first real puncturing of Israel's shield of immunity and impunity. And of course, there could be more to come, and this could give various national prosecuting authorities the courage to start actually charging and arresting Israelis accused of war crimes under universal jurisdiction if they come into their territory. Right. So it makes the world a lot smaller for Israel.
Is there anything else notable in what Khan said and these and his applications?
Yes. One thing to know about the International Criminal Court is that this court is based on the principle of complementarity. What does that mean? It means that the court defers to national authorities. So the court is not supposed to step in and prosecute crimes like crimes against humanity or war crimes or genocide, the kinds of things we've been discussing, if the national authorities of a given country are doing a competent job doing so. In other words, it's a court of last resort. And what Khan said in his statement is that complementarity requires a deferral to national authorities only when they engage in independent and impartial judicial processes that do not shield suspects and are not a sham. So by stepping in and charging Netanyahu and Gallant, Khan is saying that he believes that Israel's judicial processes and Israel's self-investigations are in fact a sham. And that by itself is quite significant. And that will send a signal again to national prosecuting authorities around the world that they may well want to start taking action under universal jurisdiction as well.
Let's talk a little bit, just for the last few minutes, about the big picture. Why Khan took the approach that he did, why it took 8 months on top of 76 years, obviously. What can you say about the intentions by the lead prosecutor?
Yeah, well, why don't we start by looking at this clip of Karim Khan giving an interview to Christiane Amanpour on CNN in the last couple of days, where he talks about how the Western powers that are initially were instrumental in setting up the court saw its role.
Of the individual is the protection of babies. I mean, these are fundamental American values that should engender bipartisan support. Now, of course, this situation, unfortunately, lies on the San Andreas fault of international politics and strategic interests. And of course, I've had some elected leaders speak to me and be very blunt. This court is built for Africa and for thugs like Putin, was what one senior leader told me. We don't view it like that. This court is the legacy of Nuremberg. This court is a sad indictment of humanity. This court should be the triumph of law over power and brute force. Grab what you can, take what you want, do what you will. And we're going to simply be, we're not going to be dissuaded by threats or any other activities, because in the end, we have to fulfill our responsibilities as prosecutors, as the men and women of the office, as judges, as the registry.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point that historically, and this has been a criticism of the ICC for a long time, that they go after, leaders in the global south, primarily Africa, while letting Western leaders off the hook without even, a passing glance. What are your thoughts on that?
Completely. And until, Khan charged Putin, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, a year ago with like a pretty thin charge.
Yeah.
The ICC had only ever gone after people in Africa. So that's why some people called it the Imperial Criminal Court or the International Colonial Court. Mm-hmm. And many countries in Africa were threatening to withdraw from it because of this bias. So I think that Khan knew, and by the way, Khan was when Fatou Bensouda's predecessor was up for replacement. Khan was actually, according to the Israeli press, Israel's favorite candidate, and he has dragged his feet and dragged his feet and dragged his feet. And as we've seen, even now that he's finally gone ahead and done the charges, he really has pulled his punches as compared to what he has every grounds to charge the Israelis with. So I think for him, he knew that he could, he couldn't get away with doing nothing while this genocide continues to unfold. So he did the bare minimum to try to preserve the credibility of the court. But it is quite shocking, and it is an indictment that he allowed a genocide to proceed for almost 8 months and sat on his hands. And then at the end of the day, there is this indictment, which is harsher against the leaders of the Palestinian resistance than against Israeli leaders perpetrating genocide. And as I said, there's so much he has ignored, which he can't keep ignoring. He's not going to save the court's credibility unless he adds more charges against a lot more Israelis soon. That said, it is still historic and unprecedented, even though he's tried to soften the blow. This is not a position Israel or the United States wants to be in. And as we can see from the outraged reactions from Tel Aviv and Washington.
Yeah, I mean, just I think it was yesterday, Lindsey Graham, one of the senators here in the U.S. said, like, well, if they're going to, go after Israel, that means we're next, kind of warning. But it's saying the quiet part out loud.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, exactly. Like, again, don't threaten us with a good time. Ali, what have the reactions been so far? By those indicted or in kind of the political sphere?
Yeah, as mentioned, not surprisingly, the reaction from Israel has been just absolutely enraged, a rejectionist, a lot of bravado. Netanyahu came out and threatened the court. He was asked, is he afraid of traveling? He said, no, but Karim Khan should be afraid of traveling around the world. I'm not sure if that was a veiled threat. just absolutely thuggish gangster stuff. The United States, of course, being just as thuggish and gangsterish as Israel. Now, let's cast our mind back a few years to the Trump administration. At that time, when Fatou Bensouda was the chief prosecutor, the Trump administration imposed sanctions on her and all the court staff and their families, banning them, for example, from traveling to the United States, banning their children from coming to study in the United States, and so on. Really petty stuff. And the Biden administration, when they came into office, they removed those sanctions. The Biden administration removed the sanctions against the court personnel. Now, in the past few weeks, before this announcement of the arrest warrants or the plan to seek the arrest warrants, you'd had this letter from 12 Republican senators threatening all sorts of sanctions in this really gangsterish way against Khan. If you go after Israel, we will go after you, basically. Now the Biden administration has come out and said that they will support bipartisan efforts to impose sanctions on the International Criminal Court and its personnel. So no difference at all between the Trump administration and the Biden administration, exactly the same policies when it comes to this. Now, and of course, recall the U.S. is not a member of the court and hasn't signed the Rome Statute. So that's that. In Europe, the situation is different because I think all the countries in Europe, certainly all the countries in the EU, are signatories, and they're in a different position because they can't simply reject this and then claim to uphold international law. So I've already cited Norway saying, if there are arrest warrants and these guys show up, we'll arrest them. The other countries across Europe have generally stated that yes, we respect the independence of the court and we respect its work and sort of grudgingly accepted it, not with a lot of enthusiasm, but let's say with resignation in varying degrees, some slightly more enthusiastic than others. I think Ireland, Spain and Belgium were a little more warm towards it. Germany, Austria, Czech Republic, some of the more extreme pro-Israel countries were a little more grudging. And then Hamas has condemned it and rejected it, as you'd expect. But interestingly, over the years, and including as recently as January, Hamas leaders have said, look, we're willing to show up at the ICC and to defend ourselves because we're confident that if we get a fair trial with cross-examination and witnesses and so on, that we will be able to defend ourselves adequately. And so, you know, we're willing to make that sacrifice if it's the price of getting Israeli leaders into court and getting some justice for our people. So Hamas has been far more willing to cooperate with the court than Israel, which is completely rejectionist.
Well, finally, shifting gears today, Norway, Spain, and Ireland jointly announced that they're recognizing the state of Palestine. This has infuriated Israel, of course. What does this mean? What is the significance of it? What is this just symbolic? What's happening?
Yeah, why don't we start by just taking a look at just a short clip of the announcement today from the Irish Taoiseach.
Stood on these same steps with Prime Minister Sanchez of Spain, and we said that the point of recognizing the state of Palestine was coming closer. That point has now arrived. Today, Ireland, Norway, and Spain are announcing that we recognize the state of Palestine. Each of us will now undertake whatever national steps are necessary to give effect to that decision. In the lead-up to today's announcement, I've spoken with a number of other leaders and counterparts, and I'm confident that further countries will join us in taking this important step in the coming weeks. This is an historic and important day for Ireland and for Palestine. On the 21st of January 1919, Ireland asked the world to recognise our right to be an independent state. Our message to the free nations of the world was a plea for international recognition of our independence, emphasising our distinct national identity, our historical struggle, and our right to self-determination and justice. Today, we use the same language to support the recognition of Palestine as a state. We do so because we believe in freedom and justice as the fundamental principles of international law, and because we believe that permanent peace can only be secured upon the basis of the free will of a free people.
I mean, what does this mean? You know, they didn't show a map, and that's always a telling.
Right. Well, that was Irish Taoiseach or Prime Minister Simon Harris, and this, you know, a similar announcement was made by Norway and Spain, and they coordinated it. And I know that a lot of people in Ireland are very proud of this, and it's sort of symbolically, people are quite happy with it. I'm going to be just a little bit of a downer. I mean, this is symbolic. Let's remember that more than 140 countries in the world, that's the vast majority, already recognize the state of Palestine, including great powers such as China and Russia. So this really doesn't change very much. It is only a handful of countries, most of them, the United States and its European satellites, who don't recognize Palestine. So I think we have to keep that in perspective. This is not a substitute for action such as sanctions. Yes, it makes people feel good, but it doesn't change anything on the ground. It remains within the paradigm of the so-called two-state solution, and we are long past that. Right. And it can even be seen more as an effort to rescue Israel than to offer real support to Palestinians, because supporters of Israel, which includes all the European countries and the United States, think that creating a Palestinian state in a tiny part of Palestine, historic Palestine, is the way to ensure Israel's long-term future. So, and this can also just be a way for governments in Ireland, Spain, and Norway, where there tends to be much more popular support for Palestine anyway, to kind of appease popular anger without doing anything practical. Yeah. So, for example, Ireland, a few years ago passed something called the Occupied Territories Bill, which would ban the sale of goods from Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank in shops in Ireland. But the government has refused to implement that law to this day. So I would be a lot more convinced if we would see the Irish government actually implementing the will of the people as expressed in this law. And to put things in sort of another perspective, all three countries, Norway, Spain, and Ireland, have sent significant amounts of weapons to Ukraine. By contrast, none of them are even close to considering that kind of practical support for the resistance in what they now supposedly recognize as a state of Palestine under foreign occupation. So I think there's a lot of reasons to temper our enthusiasm. Of course, it's very much annoying Israel, which is always a good thing and something we like to see. Israel withdrew its ambassadors from these three countries and issued very angry statements. And that's, of course, something I applaud. I encourage Israel to withdraw its ambassadors permanently from all countries in the world. So, you know, go Israel, pull out all your ambassadors, close your embassies, you show them. So that's that. And I think just it's another sort of somewhat on the positive side of the ledger. It does show disunity within the pro-Israel camp. When I say pro-Israel, when I call Ireland a pro-Israel country, let me be clear. I'm not talking about the people of Ireland. There is no people perhaps in the world as supportive of the Palestinian struggle as the people of Ireland. But the Irish state, the Irish government, is part of the pro-American camp, is part of the EU. Just a couple of days ago on Israel's so-called Independence Day, the Irish embassy in Dublin tweeted out its congratulations to Israel on its independence. So Ireland is part of the pro-Israel bloc. And this shows disunity among that bloc. It also, I think, shows that the efforts of the European Union to establish a common foreign policy, which is always based on the lowest common denominator, is failing. The EU is losing its relevance and falling apart. I personally consider that to be a good thing because I consider the EU to be a very malign force on the planet. And the final thing I'll say is that you know, to the extent that this is any sort of shift, any sort of break in the unity of the pro-Israel bloc, it came about thanks to the resistance on the ground in Gaza and not as a result of any begging and pleading by the U.S. and Israeli-backed Palestinian Authority in Ramallah.
Yeah, I think that's a big point. Well, is this going anywhere? Is this just kind of, this is where it lands? And
it remains to be seen whether this will be followed up. And I've seen, you know, politicians in Spain asking similar questions, saying, is this just a declaration or are we going to put our money where our mouth is and start taking action? You know, there's a lot short of sending arms to the resistance that Spain, Ireland, and Norway could do in terms of imposing sanctions on Israel, in terms of breaking off relations with Israel, all sorts of things they could do that they haven't done. So I think, you know, we have to our demands have to be high, our ceiling has to be high, and we have to not be satisfied with crumbs. As I said, these are among the last countries in the world to be recognizing Palestine. So let's keep it in perspective. China, Russia, India, virtually every country in Africa, virtually every country in Asia, virtually every country in Latin America have recognized Palestine for years. It's just Europe and its settler colonial extensions, you know, Canada, the US, Australia, who haven't done so yet. And so let's not exaggerate their importance by making too much more of this than it is.
Yep. Well, thank you so much, Ali. We will, of course, continue to watch the developments with the ICC.
Generators on till the cops said move along. Serve the people.